learning. And when we think about the idea of learning and memory and doing something in memory of someone who's close to us, whom we love, who we connect with, so this takes us back to a very deep and ancient Jewish tradition, which is how we always view things. You know, if you ask someone, what is the day, you could say, of arguably the holiest day of the Jewish calendar? So what would you say is that day? So some would say that day is called Yom Kippur, but it's actually legally referred to as Yom HaKippurim. The Yud Mem, the two Hebrew letters at the end of Kippurim, means there are two atonements. And the tradition has it that means that there is an atonement for those who are living, who are with us, and who are in the other world, the world of truth, the world of the souls. So how could it be that I understand we are judged every year during this period of awe, during the high holidays? What does it mean that for some of us, our parents who are in the other world, our grandparents, I look around this call, and some of you who have been in this group have spoken about your parents and grandparents. What does it mean that they're judged if they're not living? How could it be that they're judged every year on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippurim, if they are not living? So one perspective on this, and this is something that you can apply in your lives for those who have parents who are in the other world. I know some people in this call had an observance of a yard site just this week. And the idea of Yom Kippurim is that a person whose soul goes to the other world is judged every year because of the influence that they have in this world. Because your parents raised you to be a certain way, the way that you lead your life, it raises their soul every year when God says, wow, look at the influence of that person who maybe has passed away a long time ago, but the ripple effects of their life continue to be felt in concentric circles. So that's why every year when we mention and we memorialize those who have passed from before us, we are remembering them, but we're also reminding ourselves that the way that we lead our life, that is connected to their soul. So by us coming together to learn in memory of Mike Zaney, that is expanding the influence of the goodness that he brought into this world. The more people who are learning, the more time that we devote to learning, that spiritual pursuit that we're undertaking now, we're connecting that to his soul. The theme that we're going to talk about today is one word. It's the word what. And we're going to do that in light of an event. And that is that we chose, actually, originally this day was on the calendar. And when we finish, I'm going to post the schedule for the rest of the year for these Zoom events, which is going to take place at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll send out the schedule shortly. When we thought about this date, we chose this date because this past Sunday was a date on the calendar. It is actually observed, it was observed in Israel as Yom Aliyah. So I'm going to draw your attention for a moment now to a newspaper article that appeared this week in the Jerusalem Post. Here we go. Israel marks Aliyah Day. Hang on, I just need to pull it up. Let me see. Can you see it on the screen? Yes, great. Israel marks Aliyah Day with more than 15,000 new immigrants so far this year, which is it's down because of the pandemic. And yet you can imagine that 15,000 people moved to Israel this year, including one born in Bergen-Belsen, one a pro-Israel U.S. college activist, and others. So Sunday was Aliyah Day, and this is the minister of Aliyah. Sunday was Aliyah Day. So we're thinking about Aliyah and Israel and the state of Israel, and what does it mean? And there are so many things that we could talk about when we think about the concept of the state of Israel. There's one particular essay, one perspective that I'd like to share with you and introduce it, because this perspective on the state of Israel also informs how we study, learn, and teach the Holocaust, and how we deal with challenges and struggles And loss, for example, the loss that we're reflecting on most immediately today with the loss of Kelly's husband. I want to introduce you to an article, an essay, a speech that was given called Kol Dodi Do Fake. Now, I'm going to put it on the screen, but I also put a link to it in the chat. It is found on a website called Safaria, where you can find the entire link to this. So I'm going to show it to you now, but you can also get it just by tapping in the link. I also sent out an email. I'm going to share it on the screen now. I also sent out an email with the with an article, which I'm going to post in the chat now as well. This article is like a modern summary. It's a contemporary summary of reflection. Where am I? Let me see if I can find it. Here we go. By Rabbi Shalom Carmi. Bingo, I think it just came up in the chat. So you'll find in the chat the link to what you're looking at on the page in Safaria, this Kol Dodi Do Fake speech, as well as a more contemporary, what he called a Kol Dodi Do Fake primer, which is now in the chat. This article, this teaching of Kol Dodi Do Fake, it's about a 60-page piece, which I guess in those days, people had more zitzfleisch. They didn't mind sitting to listen to an extra lecture for 4 hours. We're not going to do that. Don't worry. This lecture was given on Yom HaAtzmaut, on Israel's Independence Day of 1956. So think about the context in which it was given shortly after the founding of the State of Israel, the end of the Holocaust, and as tensions were heating up in the Sinai. This talk was given by a man who is arguably one of the most influential and important Jews, intellectual figures, rabbinic giants of the 20th century. His name was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in Poland in 1903. He was the descendant of one of the most illustrious rabbinic Talmudic families, the Soloveitchik family in Eastern Europe. His mother's side was also from a rabbinic family, the Feinstein family. Some of you are familiar with that name from the Jewish world, cousin of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Soloveitchik also pursued secular studies with a PhD at the University of Berlin in philosophy and came to America to become a rabbi in Boston and, most prominently, the dean, the Rosh Yeshiva, the leading rabbinic authority at Yeshiva University, where he personally delivered thousands of lectures and ordained hundreds of rabbis. Rabbi Soloveitchik changed the face of American Jewish life and connected Jews to a tradition. And so his words that we're going to share today are contemporary reflections, but they're also deeply rooted in Jewish tradition. So I put together a little montage. It's not the most professional job, but you'll be mochel me. You'll forgive me. You'll see how it goes. But this was just to give you a little flavor so that when we read this essay, you can hear the voice of Rabbi Soloveitchik. You can see the picture and kind of put it together. So if you turn your attention to your screen now, I'm going to optimize this for you. This is a brief clip of Rabbi Soloveitchik discussing his class and what it means to be connected to previous generations when it comes to learning.
Thank you.
A Symposium of Generations. Symposium of Generations. And that's what we're going to join right now. By listening to this talk, which Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered in Yeshiva University in 1956, we are going to join that Symposium of Generations. I'm not going to say who on this call remembers the days of 1956. Let's be honest, it's before my time. But for those who connect to that time, Shale, I see you're nodding in the back there. Don't think you can't escape that. This is a way to connect to a deep Jewish teaching, which is from, on the one hand, from Rabbi Soloveitchik, from a previous generation. On the other hand, it's so important. It gets to the core of what we're talking about today, to think about Israel. So this is the man, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. This is the time, and this is the essay. I'm holding it in front of me in the print edition. You can also follow it in the link in the chat button, but don't worry, I'll explain it to you. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, it's Yom HaAtzmaut. Today is Israel's Independence Day, and it's an opportunity to reflect. We need to think. So one of the most famous parts of this essay, Rabbi Soloveitchik says that there is a knock that is happening. Rabbi Soloveitchik invokes a verse from the book of the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, Kol Dodi Dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking. God is knocking at our door. With the gift of the state of Israel, God is knocking. He gives six knocks. Six knocks that God is knocking at our door. This is a major section of the essay. So I'm just going to briefly, and it's found in that article by Rabbi Karmi, I'm going to briefly give you an overview of those six knocks. The first two knocks, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, were just political knocks. The establishment, the very establishment of the state and its victory in 1948, these were supernatural events. Nobody could have ever imagined that the Russians and the Americans, they would agree, and that the Israelis would be able, this fledgling nation, many of whom were Holocaust survivors, would be able to hold off the Arab invasion. It's almost supernatural. Third and fourth knocks, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, address Jewish self-awareness. One dispels the notion that the long and abject exile of the Jews was a sign of their rejection by God. Jews are not rejected. And the other is that everybody, even those Jews who had become assimilated, can reassess their identity as Jews. And the last two knocks, he says, relate to the physical situation of Jews. Is that, number one, people should see now that Jewish blood is no longer hefker, ownerless, that we're going to be passive victims, that we are going to stand up for ourselves. And the sixth is that Jews have a homeland. And this brings us to the Yom Aliyah, that we have a place to go, a place of refuge. We are not homeless. We have a place. So this is one key aspect. If you're thinking about how to reflect on the gift of the state of Israel, what it means to us today, six knocks: the political aspect, the identity, and also what it means for the Jewish people. Awesome. So that you can read on your own. Very important part. Then Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to make a key distinction between two kinds of covenants, two kinds of agreements, two kinds of building a community. Right? So we go from the six knocks, what Israel means, to building a community. What does Rabbi Soloveitchik do to transition from one to the other? What happens when someone knocks at your door? When someone knocks at your door, you have to do something. You have to answer. In the book of Song of Songs, what happens is that this boy and girl, they're in love with each other, and yet when the boy knocks on the door, the girl doesn't answer. She doesn't do anything. There's no what. Rabbi Soloveitchik begins to open our minds to thinking back to that word what that we opened with today. That's going to be our theme. When God knocks on the door, what do we do? When we think about creating a community, what kind of community are we talking about? So here too, when we think about, imagine the community of docents at the museum, the community of Israel, the Jewish people, however you're going to define that community, Rabbi Soloveitchik introduces two different ways two different frames of community. One community is what he calls the community of fate, and the other one is the community of destiny. If I were to ask you, and now you can unmute yourself or write it in the chat, how many covenants did God fashion with the Jewish people? Let me open up my chat here and see what's going on. How many covenants did God make with the Jewish people? You can unmute yourself or you can type it in the chat. How many covenants? Rabbi Soloveitchik is thinking about two covenants, and maybe one way that you could think about this. Okay, 13. Oh, Dina, that's the Gemara has an expression, the Talmud has an expression that there were 13 covenants, which is connected to the Brit Milah circumcision. He talks about circumcision, this essay. Awesome. Well, when God took the people out of Egypt, they were going as a band of slaves to a free nation in Israel. There were two stages, you could say. There was stage one when they left Egypt, and stage two when they got to Sinai. So two covenants. So I'll put that in the chat so we'll pretend like somebody answered my question so I'm not just sitting. Okay, there we go. It's in the chat. Two. Now you're not surprised why there's a covenant of fate and there's a covenant of destiny. What's the difference, Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, between fate up to 12? Yes. Thank you. What's the difference? How would you define the word fate versus destiny? I'll open it up to in the chat, or you can unmute. What adjectives would you use to describe the word fate? Or what affect, what do you associate with the word fate in contrast to destiny? Well, that's my question. In contrast to destiny, thank you, Shayla Myrna, and I see also Nancy is there. In contrast, how would you distinguish fate and destiny? Okay, Susan, your outcome from the stars. One answer. What else? Fate is out of control, but destiny could be. Fate happens to you. Fate, you are passive. Oh, did you guys read this essay from the Rav already? Yes, this is a big piece of it. Fate, Cecilia is also putting it in there. Fate is not something you do. Fate is something that happens, right? Fate, if you imagine, I am, okay, some says it even has a negative connotation, okay? Fate maybe has a negative connotation. Fate means this happens to be whether I choose it or not, right? It's, one second, I'm going to mute everybody again. Here we go. Fate means this is something which is in the life of people that is required, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, signifies an existence of compulsion. Jews were taken out of Egypt whether they liked it or not. That's where they were going. Right? That was the reality in which they lived. God took them out. And that, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, has a lot of aspects which are associated with it. Like the sense that we have, if we have a shared fate, if we're in the same group, so we have the same experience, whether we like it or not. We might be labeled in the same way. We might be victimized in the same way. Right? Fate is something which is, so to speak, foisted upon us. But that's very different than destiny. Destiny is something that we choose. Destiny is the covenant at Sinai where the people had to say, yes, we want to buy into this. We're not just following along. Both of these have consequences. The covenant of fate has an important consequence, and that has to do with caring for another person, right? When we are in a shared fate, when we have this shared experience, so we look at the other person, we say, well, what's happening to you? What's happening to me? But destiny has a very different connotation. So what I'm going to do now, with your permission, or without your permission, because I'm the host of this Zoom, and nobody can tell me what to do, unless somebody else knows the thing, I'm going to actually take 3 minutes to break us up into small groups. So this distinction that you've talked about over the last couple of minutes and that you mulled over in your groups, this distinction is a lot about the difference between being passive versus being active. Now, you have the essay, you have the link to Rabbi Soloveitchik, to the Kol Dodido Fake, where you can read on your own. And there he talks at great length with, you know, incredible poetry and prose, unpacking each of these, the fate side and the destiny side. And he talks about the idea, even within fate, of the shared responsibility that goes with shared suffering. Also the idea of shared activism and taking care of each other. But I definitely agree with everybody, and I think this is part of what he's trying to get at, that there is a huge difference between the passive and the active, between sitting back and leaning in. So this brings us to the main point that I think is relevant for us today in our context, which is that Rabbi Soloveitchik told us that there are six knocks of the state of Israel. And so he asked the question, what do we do now? He told us there's a difference between fate and destiny. Well, the difference between the questions of fate and destiny is very significant. The difference is that when you're in a fate circumstance, what question do you ask? Oftentimes, when you're dealing with fate, what question do you ask? What is the one word question you ask? Versus when you are in a situation of destiny, you ask a different question. Vivian Block, thank you in the chat. Why? When a person is in a fate situation, when they feel that they are the victim, they are in a passive, they sit back and they say, why? Why is this happening? Why is this my circumstance? Why am I in this spot where I am now? That's one kind of question. As opposed to when it's a question of destiny, what were people talking about before? Again, we're appropriating these terms in Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay. Destiny says, as you said, Ruth, a person, God forbid, has a disability. So what do they do now? What do they do to navigate their disability? Two different kinds of questions, both legitimate, but in the first case, the question of why is, it's a passive question. There's not a lot of empowerment there. There's not a lot you can do with the question of why, but there's a lot that you can do with the question of what. And this is actually the first part of Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay where he deals with the issue of suffering, when he deals with the issue of the Holocaust. So I'm going to share it with you. I'm going to pull it up on the screen now so you can see it. Hold on 1 second. If you don't have it, if you don't want to grab it in the chat, let me pull it up on the screen. Hold on. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. Okay, quick thumbs up. Tell me if you could see it. Okay. Rabbi Soloveitchik begins here. You see, I'm following it with the cursor, the existence of fate, the duress of against your will. It is against such a backdrop that the experience of evil surfaces in all of its terror. So he talks about evil and suffering. We have to face it, but now, he says, in short, the eye of fate asks a speculative, metaphysical question about evil, and this question is not given to solution and has no answer. In the second dimension of man's existence, destiny, the question of suffering takes on a new form. What is an existence of destiny? It is an active existence. When man confronts the environment into which he has been cast with an understanding of his uniqueness and value, freedom and capacity, we have tools, we have abilities, we can. In the existence from the perspective of fate, we say, I can't do anything. I'm just asking why, which is fine. Ina, in the chat, is it, why did this happen, but what am I supposed to do? Why is there no answer? So Ina's pointing in the chat that the distinction between these two questions is, in the first one, which is passive, the eye of fate says, why did this happen to me? But Rabbi Soloveitchik says, the mysteries of life are beyond our comprehension. Why somebody would be taken from this world at 47 with a young wife and three children, we can ask why, but unless you're a prophet, who will know why? It is one of God's mysteries. When we go back to the Holocaust and the horror and the untold destruction and suffering and death that so many of you have taught and continue to teach about, if someone were to ask you why, could anybody say why? Would anybody have the audacity or the temerity, the hubris to suggest why? Of course not. But we can still ask what. What says, what do we do now? What are we called upon? What opportunities do we have in this circumstance? Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about what? He's talking about what we've been given, on the one hand, the gift of the state of Israel. So what do we do to respond to the six knocks? He talks about the realm of tragedy, of suffering, of the Holocaust. We experience the Holocaust as a people, as a humanity, as an existence. So what do we do now? When we talk about dealing with personal struggles, these two questions are at the core. One question that people will raise is why? Why did this happen to me? Why am I in this circumstance? Why am I subject to this fate? And it's a fair question, and we should ask that question directly to God, because we need to have a relationship with God to have that meaningful connection in our life. But oftentimes, we're not going to get an answer. Who's going to tell you why? Who knows why? Only God knows. So we move away from that why question to the what question. And in our docent group, we've talked about this before, and some of the members of this group who I know in this room, in this virtual room, have dealt with this on a very personal level, with loss and bereavement and grief. But those who have experienced this probably can identify it from their own experience without philosophizing, just knowing that from a psychological standpoint, the best thing that you can do in dealing with grief, according to Dr. Felkovitz, who my teacher in psychology, deals with a lot of very difficult traumatic experiences for people, is to go from passive to active. To go from asking why to asking what. What can I do in this experience? Like they would take children who were, God forbid, they were involved in a plane crash, and they give them art projects to cope with their, you know, their loss, to go from passive to active. Going from why to what? Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay of Kol Dodi Dofek is telling us, thinking about our existence not as a fate existence, which says, why am I here, but doesn't move us forward, to an existence of what? Of destiny, of what do I do now in this circumstance, to go from passive to active in a spiritual way. Maybe that's why when we talk about the idea of the state of Israel and the people of Israel and the Jewish people and the idea of Jewish destiny, we talk a lot about hope. Hope, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs distinguishes hope from optimism. Hope versus optimism, right? We talked today about fate and destiny. Now we're going to talk about, in conclusion, hope and optimism. Optimism is a perspective that things will be good. Many of us have, and this is described by Kahneman and Tversky in their psychological research. You can read an awesome book on them, these trailblazing world-class Israeli psychologists in the Undoing Project by, what was his name? The guy who wrote Moneyball, he also wrote The Undoing Project, about our inner biases. One of the biases that we have, for many of us, is an optimism bias, that things will be good. So let's say, imagine someone's driving in the car, we're getting lost, and we don't know where to go. And I'm just saying, imagine, some of you in this room can imagine the person who's sitting next to, in the passenger seat, and she says, you know who she is, she says, why don't we stop for directions? No, no, I say it'll be fine. It's going to be good. Because I have a severe optimism bias. So most of the times in life, I'll just say, yeah, yeah, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Not everybody has that. So that can be very problematic if you have an optimism bias. Michael Lewis, thanks, Jay. Michael Lewis, that's right. But the optimism bias says everything will be fine. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks points out, Jews are not optimists. The Jews in the Holocaust were not optimists. Optimism did not help anybody. Optimism actually usually brings with it disillusionment and despair. Because to think everything will be fine, but that's not true. It's not always fine. The difference between optimism and hope is that optimism says everything will be fine. Hope says everything can be better. It can be better. It doesn't mean that it will, but it can. So there's a woman who wrote a very interesting book about hope. She was a physician for about, I forget how many years. She was a physician for a certain number of years, and then she was diagnosed with cancer. She battled cancer for 17 years, and she had to stop practicing. Let me pull up the, I'll pull it up on the screen for you. Where are we? Here we go. I'm going to pull it up on the screen so you can see. This is her book, and this is her name. Really interesting person. Here you see it. Her name is Wendy Harpam. Wendy Harpam has done a lot of research and advises clinicians, physicians, on how to use hope in dealing with patients, because she talks about the power of hope, because the power of hope, she says, is that enables patients to be active. It enables them to see that they can influence their treatment in some way. Hope, the difference between hope and optimism, you could say, optimism is fate. It says, it'll be better. It'll be better. Just sit back. It'll be better. Hope says it can be better. So let's figure out what we can do. What is within our control, right? From a, you know, thinking about it in the Holocaust frame, from like a man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl. It doesn't mean that every person thought that they could get out of their circumstance, but what can they do to frame their experience, to be active? Jews, we have a prospect every day of litzapos. We are commanded, we are called upon, we are invited, litzapos, tzipisa liyeshua, to hope for salvation. Hope for salvation does not mean sit back and be optimistic. Expect that it will come. Hope for salvation means lean in and own your destiny. What can we do to bring goodness into this world? It's the what question. And that's really the question that we started with and why we're having this group. Because by studying together, this is our first what. This is what can we do to strengthen our friend Kelly, to bring a merit to her husband's memory, to be together. We can ask why, we're not going to get a good answer. But what? We can come together and learn. We can think about what we can do to bring that light further into the world. We think about the state of Israel, Yom HaAliyah. It's not just, why did God give us the gift of the state of Israel? It's, what does that mean for us as American Jews? What is our responsibility toward the state of Israel? What's our covenant? What's our relationship with Israel? And it's the same true, of course, for the Holocaust. You ask why? I can't tell you why. Nobody can tell you why. But there are a lot of what to takeaways that the museum is presenting. So for us, this week and this month, our theme is really focused on exactly this. It's on the what. What can we do?